Innocence always calls mutely for protection, and we would be so much wiser to guard ourselves against it. Innocence is like a dumb leper who has lost his bell, wandering the world, meaning no harm. Crippled souls, startling moral inversions, and a sharp twist of the author's scalpel. That was Graham Greene in one of his most significant and most directly political novels, The Quiet American, published 70 years ago this year. Set over a few months during the First Indochina War, as the French fought a vicious and ultimately catastrophic campaign with significant and escalating economic support from the United States against nationalist and communist forces, the novel displays one of the 20th century's sharpest commentators at his best, a writer who travelled all over the world to find what was left of the human being after it had been subjected to so many long marches, putches and mobilisations. To discuss this unforgettable novel, we're joined by Jonathan Esty, PhD student at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hi, Alistair. Good to be here to bring the American perspective. I can't promise I'll be all that quiet, though.
Great. Graham Greene was, I think, as one contemporary commentator put it, a novelist who mined newspapers for material, perhaps more than any other. Could you give a flavour of the history that he's taking in The Quiet American? What are the French doing in Indochina? What are they attempting to defend? And why are the Americans funding it?
Absolutely. Well, French presence in a kind of missionary capacity goes back to even the 1600s with the Jesuits. But in the period we're looking at, this is really a later phase, starting first under the Second Empire and really accelerating under the Third Republic. And my personal take, not sure if this is widely accepted, is that the French colonization of Indochina was kind of one of these attempts to bypass an obviously growing industrial and manpower inferiority vis-a-vis Russia and then Germany. I think it's not a coincidence that colonization efforts sort of accelerate after 1871. So anyway, it's quite interesting that by the time we get to the eventual breakdown of French colonial authority during and after World War II, it's actually quite a young colony. So Ho Chi Minh, for instance, his life essentially exactly brackets the period of full French colonial domination of the region of Vietnam and then eventually Cambodia, Laos, and a few adjacent regions. And so he's born in 1899, and I believe that is basically the period when you can say the French have full control. So as with the British colonies throughout the region, the swift Japanese conquest had destroyed the idea of a obvious domination by white European forces and really tarnished French colonial prestige to a way that never really came back, despite French efforts to claw it back after 1945. So where we sit in the world of the novel circa 1951-52, the Declaration of Vietnamese Independence by Ho Chi Minh and his Viet Minh forces in 1945 is met by a pretty swift French crackback. That means the French control all the major cities, all the major supply routes, and even to some extent, large spots of the countryside. But this authority is basically a mile wide and an inch deep. And by 1951-52, we're transitioning from a guerrilla phase of the conflict into a more conventional phase where the Viet Minh are feeling confident enough to begin engaging in set-piece battles. And also the war, initially popular. De Gaulle is out of power at this time, but I would see the efforts to hold on to Indochina as part of the kind of idea of grand jour, right? The idea that the French are a great power because they have an empire and because they're bringing the civilizing mission. So it's a pivot point both from guerrilla to conventional war. It's also a pivot point in the war becoming seen more obviously through a Cold War lens. It's a bit of a misnomer to think that the Americans get involved in Vietnam only because of Korea. Truman was actually already pivoting to support the French as early as 1949 before engagement in Korea and before the kind of true militarization of the Cold War. But we're really shifting towards the contours of the kind of glimmerings of the Vietnam War that we in America would simply call the Vietnam War rather than the Second Indochina War. And Graham Greene, I think, will always get immense credit for having presciently seen the contours of this shift from the old colonialists to the new, young, fresh, and shiny neo-colonialists, when we find ourselves at the very start of the war, that is in 1945, with the end of World War II, there is this sort of starting gun, I suppose, which is the Japanese surrender. And as in Manchuria, as in Malaysia and the Philippines, there's this scramble to see who will reassert authority first. And even during the period when Vichy was controlling Indochina, there was kind of this sense of angling for advantage after the end of the war. So the Viet Minh and Ho Chi Minh's forces are able to be first on the spot, as it were, as in to establish physical control over North Vietnam. But the French are able to dispatch an expeditionary force under de Gaulle actually quite quickly in 1945. It's one of their number one priorities after the vanquishing of Germany and the kind of reestablishing of authority on the continent. But I would say that early Russia successes is quite illusory. And so throughout the late 40s, we get into a period of pretty nasty guerrilla war, mostly in the countryside and largely in the north. The other thing that transforms the strategic situation is, of course, the quote, loss of China. That is to say, the Chinese Communist Party victory in 1949 and consolidation by 1950. That means that there's now a, rather than an ally across the border, there is a Chinese Communist force allied to Ho Chi Minh, and makes it quite easy to smuggle arms, materiel, and in some cases, advisors and supporting troops across the border from China. So the various bombing missions, the bicycle bomb campaign that we see in the novel, a lot of that is drawn pretty directly from Greene's reporting at the time. So what remains murky, both in the historical record then and now, is questions of direct responsibility. Quite obviously, the French forces are to blame when they, strafe a peasant village for essentially no other reason than they're in a communist occupied zone and are available as targets to, I believe, Graham Greene says something to the effect of to add their daily quota of death. But the bicycle campaigns and a campaign of urban bombing, it's unclear whether this is the Viet Minh themselves, a kind of false flag operation by the French secret police, whether it was some nebulous third or fourth force, the various inscrutable mishmash of various groups. I might mangle the pronunciation here, but there's the Cao Daists, who are a sort of Confucian syncretic organization. There's also the Hohoas, who are another sort of neo-Buddhist cult or sect. So the main opposition forces to the Viet Minh are initially not what we'll get to later, which is sort of a shiny American-backed, modernizing, progressive force, but these sort of secret societies that have been active for decades or even centuries in some cases that hark back more to Vietnam's imperial and Confucian tradition. So the situation on the ground is getting increasingly bad for the French and increasingly inscrutable to outsiders. And so the attempt to overlay a bipolar lens on top of this and say it's ultimately about communism versus anti-communism really does a great deal of violence to what was a quite chaotic free-for-all melee by the time you get to 1951-52.
We talked about Ho Chi Minh's Declaration of Independence in 45. There is an American involvement there, isn't there? There are OSS officers in the audience, and Ho Chi Minh quotes from the American Declaration of Independence. So, I mean,
Yeah,
you've got your original
it's
quiet
so
American.
fascinating. Yeah, so there's actually an even longer prehistory. Are you aware of the Wilsonian connection here? Because if not, I can get into
No,
that.
please.
So this has been contested, but the story goes that a young Ho Chi Minh, then under a different alias, was in Paris at the time of the Versailles peace negotiations and attempted to have an audience with Wilson and top leaders bearing a petition from a coalition of Vietnamese nationalist forces, but that he was kind of not even shown the door, couldn't even get into the office, basically, which is unsurprising for a young radical, working in a kitchen to make bills meet, whose French was quite imperfect and so on. But what I'm getting at here is a lot of scholars, including Erez Manella, whose book, The Wilsonian Moment, kind of sees it as a almost an original sin of American power in the post-World War I and then post-World War II era, that is to say, making a Faustian pact with Anglo-French colonialism at the expense of what will later become called the Third World or the Global South. And Fred Loguval, whose book Embers of War really is, I think, the definitive text on this connection between the French phase of the Indochina War, the Vietnam War, and the American phase, also has this as the prologue of a young Ho Chi Minh in Paris. I think some later scholars have contested how central Ho was at this time. Was it even realistic he could have gotten an audience? And probably not. But the fact that these figures were there and there was this sort of multiple missed opportunities for Ho Chi Minh not to be the inveterate enemy of America and American power, and the idea of American leadership not offering the proffered hand, not accepting the proffered handshake, I think is quite disturbing to think about.
Hi, Jonathan. It's Paul here, Paul Lay. It's interesting when both reading the book and reading the history of this period that there are many kinds of imperialism. You know, I think we tend to see Western imperialism as one thing, but I just wondered that there seems to be huge contrast, which the book, the novel, The Quiet American, develops between British, French, and US colonialism or neo-colonialism, however way you wish to words you wish to use. But I wonder if there is a coherent French strategy after the Second World War that allows us to compare their actions in Indochina, for example, with the calamities in Algeria and other parts. Because the decolonization, the post-Second World War decolonization by the French of their colonies is not a hugely successful one. And I wonder if it was a coherent one.
I would really struggle to find coherence just because I had to actually look up the number of different French cabinet governments during this period. And just in the period 45-54, the count I'm seeing is 14 different parties or coalitions, often only in power for, in some cases, 6 months, sometimes as little as 6 weeks. So it's, you know, centers and radicals and communists. It's, you know, it is really all over the place. So I think the common factor, I think, is continuing de Gaulle's thrust to reassert French power in the world, French autonomy, obviously not to the same degree we later see with a more self-confident France breaking free from NATO ties, etc. But what I would see there is really a need to have control over Indochina, I would say ultimately more for what you might call a reason of Greek thumos, you know, spiritedness, pride, rather than some rational calculation of national interest. I mean, yes, Indochina had supplied manpower to the French war effort in World War I, as did the North African colonies. As for the linkage between decolonization in North Africa and in Indochina, I think the really nasty linkage, I think, is the humiliation and simmering bitter resentment from what's seen as the truly unmitigated debacle of French defeat in Indochina, especially the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, a completely self-inflicted wound. So I alluded to this offline, Alistair, but Jean Lartigue's novel, The Centurions, Les Centurions, is basically an exact account of that linkage. So it begins in a prison camp with the defeated French officers at Dien Bien Phu talking amongst themselves. Some say this is a failure of leadership. Some say it's a failure to understand the Vietnamese psyche. Some talk about it in kind of apocalyptic anti-communist terms. But the result is a clique of officers basically decide what happened was we were betrayed by the civilian authorities. We were not given a free hand. And that is where you get not just the idea that in Algeria, which let's note, is a colony of much older vintage than Indochina, with a much larger, the so-called pied noir, white French population in Algeria is upwards of 1 million at the time. It's defined not as a colony, but as a core department of metropolitan France. And the idea is, well, we've lost in this outpost of French colonial grandeur and civilizing mission in the Far East. But really, that's just the prelude. That was always sort of discretionary or about augmenting France's power. Algeria is the core of France's sense of identity as a nation, more than a nation, the nation of nations. And I think the idea that many French officers took away was, we have to win at all costs, which means no letting civilians tie our hands. We have got to ignore or bypass or even, if necessary, overthrow the parliaments that are telling us we can't torture, we can't bomb indiscriminately, we can't do increasingly brutal tactics to win.
That's the view put by the journalist Bernard Fall in a series of kind of reportage books from his time in Indochina, which are the narrative is broadly as you describe it. He was on the spot, and his account was the autocracy in France for several decades, that it was the politics that was the problem. And then there's this focus on heroism. So there's so many legends from the Indochina conflict and in Algeria, actually, of, for example, the myths of the Legion, for example, as a kind of instrument of French power, heroic stories. And there are some genuinely remarkable stories and some deeply weird characters. I'm thinking of the High Commissioner in 1946 in Indochina, this guy called Thierry d'Argenlieu, who before the Second World War was an abbot. He was a Carmelite abbot, and he was nicknamed the Bloody Monk in Paris by the left-wing press. And it's that kind of personality, I think, basically kind of deranged people who have been ruined by the effects of occupation and often were in prisons, and some of whom actually were heroic in the Second World War. There's a fantastic bit, I think, in that film, La Bataille d'Alger, where one of the commanders, and there are lots of similarities between that film. If listeners go away and watch that film, it's quite sort of Graham Greene-esque in some ways, that kind of mix of reportage and adventure and almost kind of literary qualities. But there's a really brilliant moment where one of the commanders is criticised by a journalist for brutality. And the commander says, "How dare you criticise me? I was in the resistance and I will do what it takes." And it's sort of, it's just deranged. And I think you're absolutely right, Jonathan, to just focus on the coherent strategy is one of deranged, like, pain, I think, and
or self-assertion, or an
self-assertion
idea that...
yes,
but it's self-assertion, surely it's self-assertion following the trauma of the Second World War here. Because although France is ostensibly a victor in the Second World War, it clearly isn't a victor in the way that the US, the UK and its empire, and the Soviet Union were. It's a kind of victor in name only. And you can't help get this sense that it's overcompensating this appeal to glory for the lack of glory that is there between 40 and 45, or at least 40 and 44.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a phrase that I think comes out of the Italian fascist movement, which called the World War One victory a mutilated victory, Vittoria Mutilata. But that is, I think, very much how many of this officer corps feels, that, as you say, victor in name only, but have been marked by, you know, it's the beginning of the myth of French military impotence that we're still living with today in the with the so-called cheese-eating surrender monkeys of the second Bush era. About this, as you say, like deranged infliction of pain or this need for self-assertion and wounded pride, the epigraph to the Centurions that I have here is a quite eerie, it's using a quote from the Roman centurion Marcus Flavinius. If you don't mind, I might read just a sentence from this. I think it really does capture the reason why we have this hard core of officers who feel aggrieved and embittered and a need to go even further to avoid further humiliation. So the quote is this: "We had been told on leaving our native soil that we were going to defend the sacred rights conferred on us by so many of our citizens settled overseas, so many years of our presence, so many benefits brought by us to populations in need of our assistance and our civilization. If it should be otherwise, if we should have to leave our bleached bones on these desert sands in vain, then beware of the anger of the legions." And I think the anger of the legions is what you get with the attempted, in some cases successful, coups that eventually bring down the Fourth Republic and bring de Gaulle back to power, and even then try to assassinate de Gaulle, as fictionalized in Day of the Jackal and other depictions. Yeah.
Well, even only a few years ago, you had an open letter from senior people in the French military describing themselves as the generation of fire, people who'd fought in the campaigns in the Sahel, criticizing the French state and saying that you can expect a reaction from the officer class. So that, I mean, I don't know how seriously that was meant. It was about 8 or 9 years ago now. But there were the language... You can't help but remember all those events, and there are kind of dim echoes there. Yeah, I think we should turn now specifically to the novel. And yeah, Graham Greene was great at scene setting. And we start the novel with a journalist. And Greene was a journalist. He spent several winters in Indochina in the period he's talking about, up to 55. So, yeah, Jonathan, set the scene of where does it begin? Where does our little human tragedy of what it is? I don't know, this little microcosmic drama that takes place in the novel.
So I would say it's a murder mystery from the perspective of the murderer, or at least debatably the accomplice to the murderer. And we open with the discovery that our title character, the Quiet American, is dead. and then embark upon an extended flashback sequence that is the majority of the novel. And we gradually get peeled back why our pseudo Graham Greene, Thomas Fowler, would have reasons to, both politically and personally, have reasons to do away with Alden Pyle. So I think this is a novel best understood as a love triangle as geopolitical allegory, with Thomas Fowler standing in, not so much for Britain as for old colonialism writ large, and Fowler kind of voluntarily associates himself with the French in that. Alden Pyle is sort of young America, young American influence, and then Phuong, the Vietnamese woman desired by both men, as not just Vietnam, but more broadly speaking, the Third World and the decolonizing world. And of course, there's other characters. Actually, this is my second reread, and I had forgotten how much Inspector Vigo is also a very interesting philosophical presence, the detective who is investigating Fowler for complicity in the murder.
Yeah. With his green eye shades and his edition of Pascal's Pensées in front of him on his desk. It's wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah. There's more of a mourning for the passing away of the French colonial, for all that we just spent 20 minutes talking about the brutality and horrors of the French imperial presence. I think actually, to my mind, Greene saw the French colonial presence as ineffectual but philosophical. You know, they were meant to be reading Voltaire and Montesquieu in the cafes modeled on Haussmann's boulevards, but instead, you know, the vital force of the Viet Minh will sweep it away and leave behind this residue of culture that will fade. That was how I understood that.
Well, Thomas Fowler quotes Baudelaire early on. He's half in love with his opium addiction, which again is brings you back to people like the Symbolists and Rambo and Baudelaire. But he maybe, yeah, he's half in love with that, with a picture of French culture.
Absolutely. And beginning a long tradition of somewhat drug-addled British journalists going abroad to be war correspondents.
Yeah,
I think the way that we sort of encounter Pyle first, I would say, as kind of a interesting foil to Fowler's cynicism, and not just in the realm of, again, politics and ideology, but also about women and about romance and love, that Pyle is repulsed and kind of viscerally horrified by the women in the brothel, the house of 500 girls, whereas Fowler's a bit more kind of has a bit more equanimity about it and has clearly frequented such places for quite a bit before becoming monogamous. And I think with the characters both as kind of national stereotypes and as characters, it's interesting that we occasionally get comments that people pluck out of the novel to talk about wider political currents, the famous "One must pick sides if one is to remain human," is actually about the interpersonal, not so much about the political. Mm. But there's a comment about that we begin, you know, young and full of fire, and by our old age, we become monogamous. But there's also the comment that the young are a jungle of complications and we simplify as we get older, which is talking about people. But in theory, it could be young nations are a jungle of complications. And by the time you age into being an elder statesman of nations, as Fowler's Britain or the French colonialist are, you've come to understand yourself or achieved a sense of your own.
I think that's very interesting because you talk about this triangle, and obviously there is the triangle within the novel itself, the personal one. But there's also a triangle there of different kinds of imperialism, which is sort of what I was trying to get to before, is that one is an aged, essentially materialistic one, based upon trade. It's a naval country, I'm talking about Britain. It's essentially a pragmatic way of taking goods for the national interest. The French one, and remember the United States and France, certainly the later France, certainly the France that was imperial in the 19th century, is an Enlightenment project. They can't simply say that they're going out there for land grab or to enrich themselves. There has to be a deeper philosophical basis for that. And so therefore, in a way, when he's talking about Pascal, when he's talking about French philosophy, he may prefer that in some high artistic, aesthetic way to say the American vulgarity that's there. But the Americans also are an Enlightenment nation and have to have these reasons for doing things that I think the Briton, Fowler, is simply sceptical, he's cynical. And I think that does reflect the difference, at least between the early British Empire and the way it developed, and a later French and certainly American neo-colonial one. There has to be justification within those Enlightenment projects for what they do that has to go beyond the sheer material.
Well, this plays out with Pyle's relationship with Phuong. So there is this love triangle where Anh Phuong is the Vietnamese lover of Fowler. Pyle reasons for trying to take Phuong from him because he explains his reasons to Fowler throughout the novel. He's very polite, I think. Fowler says that about Pyle. He's very courteous. So Pyle repeatedly sort of requests of Fowler, you know, is it okay if I'm in love with your girlfriend? And the reasons are sort of extraordinary. He sort of says, it's a bit like what you were saying, Jonathan. Pyle wants to marry her, basically. And he's concerned that Fowler is never going to marry her. He's going to leave her as kind of just one more Vietnamese girl and go back to the UK. And
it's Fowler, just an exchange.
Exactly, it's just an exchange. And Fowler, incidentally, is married throughout most of the novel to someone in Britain who refuses to divorce him.
For Catholic reasons, which becomes very critical later on. Exactly. You talk about the Catholicism. I think they put the Catholicism in a bucket until a bit later.
Yeah, and Fowler himself is broadly atheistic. We can get onto his kind of how he develops as a character as well. But Pyle's reasoning, isn't it kind of fits in with what you're saying, Paul. He has to give a reason. He doesn't just take... And I think Fowler's a bit annoyed with Pyle. He just sort of thinks, why don't you just take a girl if you want her? Mm. But Pyle feels like he has to explain why.
He has to have a reason.
He has to give her a new life. Yeah. He has to take her back to America and introduce her to his middle-class family. He has to, and he sort of says, oh, I'll make it work. It's going to be, you know, she can be part of the community. And Fowler sees this with deep cynicism. He sort of says, well, she's always going to be connected to this country, to Vietnam. And the frustrating and interesting thing about Fowler's relationship to Phuong and the narrator's relationship to Phuong is I don't think we ever get beyond Fowler's view of Phuong, which seems to me as a series of beautifully constructed camera shots of Vietnam. Fowler is such a detached narrator. He sort of sees her. There's a brilliant bit right at the start where he says she reminds when they get back together, Phuong reminds him of the clink of the teapot. She's sort of a beautiful object, like Vietnam is a beautiful object to Fowler, a kind of scene among other beautiful scenes.
Well, you see that.
And the novel the novel's very interesting in the sense that it kind of breaks down that detachment for Fowler, and we can talk about what Fowler goes through, a kind of quest, a kind of journey, which is a dark parallel to Pyle's quest and adventure and journey too.
But you can see that's why it could be argued that Fowler makes such a great reporter, because he just simply doesn't become involved. He's emotionally loose from these things. It's just pragmatic. It's just deals. That's all it is with him. And when he has to make, or he's threatened with the possibility that he'll have to have opinions and judgments, with this terrifying prospect of being appointed a leader writer and going back to London and being a leader writer who must offer opinions and judgments, it terrifies him. It's the worst thing in the world. He's an observer. He's not a judge.
Well, it's also the case that he is able to be detached from the world of judgment, both him judging others and him being judged himself, mm-hmm. defined by his broken marriage with his wife. And this is why, I mean, I think we can come out and say it. Phuong is a beautiful cardboard cutout. I think that she never evinces any view or opinion that's not about sort of broad and bland affection for Fowler himself, and then eventually for Pyle, but sort of on the mercenary calculus that he represents. I believe it's youth and seriousness and purpose, the kind of the American way.
Yeah.
What I think is interesting is that Fowler, I think we shouldn't take Fowler's view of her as flat, as something beyond Fowler's own impression. I mean, similarly, when Fowler first meets Pyle, he says something to the effect of, I learned that he was determined to do good, not to any individual person, but to a country, a continent, a world, a whole universe to improve now. But interestingly, of course, that's not the case, right? Pretty quickly, Pyle becomes fixated on improving and doing good to Phuong. So his universalist impulses latch onto a specific target or a specific recipient. But I think your discussion of the kind of universalizing tendency in the French civilizing mission, I think, really does relate to the American sense of purpose, especially in the early crusader moment of the Cold War.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've got this triangle. But the thing that fascinates me about The Quiet American there are shades of almost mythopoetic themes in that novel. There are various towers, which the characters go into where they tell truths to each other. Towers in myth are always associated with some sort of wisdom somewhere. There is even a River Styx bit where there's a kind of river full of death in one of the scenes where he goes out, where Fowler is actually reporting on the conflict. He's out there seeing what's really happening. But because it's laced in with that kind of dull, almost flat reportage quality, it's quite easy to miss that. And you kind of get this sense. I remember reading this novel as a teenager, and I remember being struck, because I knew nothing about Indochina and Vietnam, just simply that it had a dreamlike quality, that reading it felt like you were trapped in a kind of phantasmagoric limbo. And I think Fowler is trapped in this limbo, this kind of thickening greyness. And it's a very Conradian image. It reminds me of Marlowe in Heart of Darkness, some of his discussions around mortality, this idea of the modern human being stuck in a greyness, you know, battling against a greyness. But then the novel becomes something different. So I kind of want, yeah, Jonathan, what do you think of this idea of, it's like these mythopoetic elements get kind of jumbled up and then flattened out into this kind of, this is what the 20th century's done to it. It's flattened everything. It's become, made it grey into a kind of nullity. And what happens to human beings when you do that to them?
I guess we have to come to the Catholic stuff sooner than expected, because I too read this in high school. I was, again, as you say, largely unaware of the historical context, and I would say totally unaware of Graham Greene's sort of tortured journey to Catholicism. You were kind of hearkening back to some Greek myth elements. I think that I'd missed the possibility of a River Styx comparison. What I was struck by was the sense that what ultimately, you know, really degrades reality around Pyle in the eyes of Fowler isn't even that he's this blundering idiot, this leper spreading contagion around him, is all of middle brow stuff that you can sneer at, which Fowler / Green does sneer at, about Canasta and Harvard Yard and York Harding's terrible geopolitical books. But the comment I was struck by was basically seeming to think that Pyle has this idealistic utilitarianism that I think you're right is sort of like extremely modern, extremely mid-20th century utilitarian, and that it justifies a heap of corpses, which we in fact literally get. I believe the comment is you have the third force in national democracy all over your right shoe was the kind of cutting comment. But the place where I think the antidote to a Pyle style, you know, ends justify the means, McCarthyite cold warrior mentality is when Green or Fowler rather says, suffering is not increased by numbers. One body can contain all the suffering the world can feel.
Yeah.
And he's talking about a mourning mother who's had her daughter killed by the bicycle bombing that Pyle is complicit in. But when we hear that one body can contain all the world's suffering, what is that but not the Christ story, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there's an idea that Pyle doesn't get it, that Pyle doesn't understand the idea that this is not a numbers game.
Yeah. And there are two mothers. There's one dead mother clutching a baby who's also dead, and that's in the first involvement in the war, which again is a kind of Pieta image. And that really affects Fowler when he sees that. It's the kind of end point of a French operation to secure some canal, and he sees this mother clutching her baby. And then there's the second, you're right, when the bomb goes off and the baby is dead. And that affects Fowler in some way. And that's, you know, that absolutely is that Catholic theme. But there is also, on the other side, a kind of humanistic theme to Green. And he resented being pigeonholed as a Catholic writer. And I understand why he would resent that. And there are those who argue that Catholicism in his earlier novels functions something like a framing device rather than the kind of deep intellectual allegiance. And he wore it quite lightly, let's put it that way, his Catholicism, especially in his personal life. But I think there's a kind of humanistic thing. And I wonder, if we think about Green's place within the English novel, there is a kind of dark parallel between Graham Greene and the generation that preceded him, Virginia Woolf and E.M. Forster, who he described as paper thin because they didn't engage with religion. And E.M. Forster's a kind of, it's really quite secular world. But the comparison between Forster and Greene is they're both kind of humanists in a vague way. And E.M. Forster always wants his characters to act as human beings, to embrace the burden of being human. That's why he says things like only connect. You know, we have to accept our responsibility to others. And I think with Greene, there's a kind of inversion that goes on. It's a sort of only contaminate. Because we're all linked through networks of guilt and pain and violence, unless you accept that and sort of act accordingly, that's the road to evil. And I think it's interesting what you said about Pyle. Pyle is irredeemable by the end and sort of has to die because he doesn't let the thing... He sort of kids himself about reality. And I think that, for Greene, that's the worst thing you can say about
someone. Well, I think that's where the myth comes in again, because it's interesting in the points that you've made about the use of mythology and mythological scenes that are set there, because it's very prescient of what came after the Vietnam War from American cinema, I'm thinking of in particular. I'm the only one of the three of us who's old enough to have watched the Vietnam War unfold nightly on television. And it was so far removed from any mythology then that I think it had to be mythologized later on because it was too much to bear. And, you know, I visited Washington, D.C. I've seen the Vietnam War Memorial, which I think is extremely well done because it's just the names of people, the brutality, the pointlessness of it all. Is there, and talking of the Bloomsbury set and people around there, I'm thinking of T.S. Eliot's observation that mankind can only bear so much reality. And it's interesting the way the Vietnam War is, in a sense, mythologized, the French one at this point, in The Quiet American. There is this strong mythological element. There is then the harsh reality of the Vietnam War as fought by the US that unfolds nightly across the world and particularly at the heart of America. And then that itself is mythologized again so it's palatable. So, for example, a film like Apocalypse Now, which I think is a cinematic masterpiece, masks almost everything that happens really in... it glamorizes, in essence, not simplistically, but it is a glamorous account of a tawdry, miserable world that I think Greene does observe because he is a journalist. Above all, he is a journalist as much as he is a novelist.
Well, Platoon, as another counterexample, is obviously an Iliadic framing. So the main kind of antagonism in Platoon between the best fighter, who's incredibly brutal, and the man who cares about his troops, who's you know, cares about the society, human society, is obviously a recapitulation of Hector and Achilles. So I completely see what you mean, Paul. There's this grasping for mythopoetic themes.
Well, I think it's interesting as well from a British perspective, is if Britain has something that's equivalent to the US experience in the Vietnam War, it's Northern Ireland, the Troubles in Northern Ireland, and yet that has failed to be mythologized, because to a certain extent that British imperial legacy doesn't need rationalizing. It doesn't need post-rationalizing because it never needed rationalizing in the first place. And I think that says something about the difference between French, US and British imperialism in general.
Well, there's the question of whether or not Pyle himself is the villain, you know, blundering about with blood on his shoe. And unlike, say, a real Kurtz figure who's reveling in blood and death and kind of embracing it and sort of worshiping war and destruction and death, instead, Pyle feels bad about it. Pyle is guilty. And yet the moment that we see Fowler, who's at this point been sort of waffling on whether or not to actually set in motion the plan that will result in Pyle getting knifed, he basically hears Pyle say, "We've wired to Washington. We'll get permission to use some of our funds, that is, to pay out indemnities to the surviving kin of those slain in the bombing." And then Fowler interrupts the Vieux Moulin between 9 and 9:30, setting the exact circumstances needed to set in motion the assassination. So it is the mention of blood money, or it's the mention, the idea that in American infinite carelessness, you can make it go away with money and sanitize the problem away, that really turns Fowler's stomach and turns him towards murder. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the question. Is it the idea that Pyle isn't only a splundering leper, but also wants to have clean hands, wants absolution? through the money nexus.
Yeah, I think it's that hypocrisy, really. And that's where that humanism comes in, the refusal to just respond as a... I think this is where Green is a very acute observer of human beings, that it's in the small little mental associations we make that sometimes that's where the gross evil, that's the source of the greatest evil, these little lies we tell ourselves. And Pyle, in fact, in the novel, is actually very close to being the hero. He saves Fowler's life. He gets the girl, Fuong. So, you know, he can walk away from this as a kind of successful figure. His bicycle bomb doesn't really work. So that's the first bombing that he orchestrates. It injures someone or something. No one dies. He even says when the bomb goes off, which kills a huge number of people and Fowler's there to Pyle, oh, you know, I wouldn't have done it if this were the case. And it was supposed to be a parade, launched as a parade rather than just... I was misinformed. And I think it's that interesting relationship between them. And I think we can talk... When Pyle saves Fowler's life, and it's a really bravura section of the novel where Pyle and Fowler are driving through the Vietnamese countryside where there's, another almost cinematic shift. And Green said that he wrote with a camera's eye between the golden sunsets over the fields to a kind of darkening greyness, and their car breaks down. They, both of them, look for safety in a tower, which I believe was one of the many edifices which the French put up in their kind of pointless attempts to try and control the countrysides, these towers threaded throughout the country. And then they go in, and there's these two Vietnamese soldiers in there who are fighting for the French. And there's a sort of philosophical discussion that goes on between Pyle and Fowler in the tower. They are then attacked by Viet Minh operatives. Pyle and Fowler escape, but the Vietnamese soldiers inside, one of them is apparently blown to bits, and the other one is clearly really, really injured. And they hide in the rice paddies. And they survive. And Fowler has this wonderful bit, you know, where he sort of says to Pyle, why are you saving me? He's broken his leg. And he sort of... And Pyle lifts him on his shoulders, almost like a father lifting up his son. And Fowler's complaining. He's like, why are you bothering? And there's this bit where he talks about flirting with death, which I think stands for Green throughout his life. I think why Green often mythologized this idea that he was sort of half in love with his own destruction, it's because he did feel a bit like that. There's this kind of obsession with this flirtation with death, this kind of constant, it's like a sort of little masquerade. Mm. Pyle is almost, he's the hero then.
I suspect that's true of many war reporters, that they feel the thrill. This is pretty well documented, I think, that that war reporters feel that thrill. Mm. War photographers, likes of Don McCullum, people like that, have talked endlessly about this need for the adrenaline rush when they accompany troops in battle. And I suppose that's one of the interesting things about the Vietnam War, is it was incredibly well documented, and it gave us a lot of the mythology of the war correspondent, whether it was the person writing there or whether it was the photographer. The photographer in particular came of age, really, I think, in particular during the Vietnam War, even more so than during the Second World War. Reputations were forged. And so different from conflict now, where we've got major conflicts in Ukraine, in Gaza, and we have so little real documentation from Western reporters on the ground there. And it's so, so different. And I think that although imperial nations lost a great deal, news reporting during the 50s, 60s and 70s reached a new height, often because of the way it documented conflict, whether it was the Vietnam War, whether it was the Six-Day War in Israel, whether it was the Indian-Bangladesh War. Reporters were on the ground in the way that they haven't been, for obvious reasons, in wars over the last 25 years or so.
That's an interesting question. I mean, what it raises for me is the idea that perhaps Vietnam, both in its French phase and its American phase, was a uniquely brutal and uniquely horrible conflict with just protracted, drawn out, nasty rounds of violence. And it's possible that that war is hell, and a very well-documented war will shine a light on all the nooks and crannies and crevices where the kind of the darkest atrocities lurk. And obviously not all wars are created equal, but I think it's both true that Vietnam was quite bad in an objective sense, and also true that it was, as you say, better documented. I'm not sure that today we've lost the almost literary or artistic spirit of a Graham Greene or even a Cronkite as a commentator to kind of shape the narrative and shape the analysis. No. But I think it is hyper-documented in the sense of in the billions of eyes watching video sent out by Palestinians, by Ukrainians. I think, still you see a stark division between, say, Sudan, where it's not as well documented because there's a much worse connectivity, a much more impoverished population, and much less the global diaspora. But that's a little far afield. But I think sort of, is Fowler's character a conduit for news reporting that concretely shapes the conflict? I think we're not led to think so. As much as he says, what I'm there for is this neutral lens and I must be uninvolved, it seems ultimately kind of sterile or ultimately kind of impotent. Or at least that's how I read Green is depicting it. And Alistair, you invoked the idea that maybe the novel turns at the end to give sort of more credence to Pyle, or maybe that his ideas aren't quite as completely wrongheaded as we might have thought. There was this line that Fowler remarks that all the time Pyle's innocence had angered me, but at the same time, some judge within myself had summed up in his favor, compared his idealism, his half-baked ideas founded on the works of York Harding, with my cynicism. Oh, I was right about the facts, but wasn't he right too to be young and mistaken? And I think that's the question of whether or not there's an admiration there on the part of Fowler or Green, for even in its wrongheadedness, at least there's an energy, there's a vitality, there's a forward thrust, and that if you followed the perspective of neutral detachment, not only would events not proceed, but you'd remain perfectly cynical and perfectly isolated from human contact.
Yeah, which in a sense provokes Fowler's action at the end. He doesn't murder Pyle himself, but he sets the operation in motion. He knows exactly what's going to happen. I think the novel ends on a very sort of ironic note. It really reminds me of The Third Man, of which Graham Greene wrote and also worked on the screenplay. This sort of, the way it ends, that kind of slight ironic twist, the sense that for all Harry Lime in The Third Man, Harry Lime's grotesqueries, that there's something oddly admirable about Harry Lime in the end. And it's the same with Fowler. He kind of wins, and he wins the girl back, Fuong. His wife, sort of like a deus ex machina, grants him a divorce at the same time. And the paper says he can stay in Vietnam for a while longer. So he kind of gets everything he wants. And there's that wonderful ironic twist right at the end where he says, I wish I had someone to say I was sorry. that's the thing that just bugs him. I wish I could say I was sorry to someone. And he's interrogated about the murder by Vigo, the French inspector. And he has this impulse to tell Vigo that he, in a sense, or to almost inform him about what has happened. But then he withdraws and he says, as Vigo's walking off, oh, I wish I'd had the courage to say what I'd done. And I wonder how that frames this idea of moral commitment, when sometimes there's this ironic charm thing that although you can make the big act of moral courage, which in a sense is to deliver Pyle's fate, to act as that kind of instrument of grace and salvation, you can walk away scot-free. And I think that's also a very 20th century theme, the idea that many, many people suffered, but for some reason, some people just sort of walked off scot-free into the sunset.
Speaking of why people are, as war correspondents do, seeking the thrill of battle or the thrill of near-miss mortality, apparently Green himself said he went to Indochina because he was trying to recapture the feeling that he'd gotten during the Blitz. And that he'd felt more alive at that moment and so needed to feel something like that again.
Yeah, and Fowler says that repeatedly in the novel, and that absolutely rings true. And if you read one of Graham Greene's other great, arguably one of his best novels, The End of the Affair, that's brilliant on that kind of thrill, romance, desire, all of these things connecting. But I think why Greene in The Quiet American is such a successful novel in a way, and it's been so admired, it's because I think it is... will capture, I think, for many people, that experience of the of those years in the 20th century when many people were treated like human material. But there was also in parallel this kind of charmed existence that was available if your cards fell right, in a way. I don't know whether that's a bit overstating it.
It is a novel of the European in East Asia. It's quite interesting.
You have the luxury of looking.
It's a picture of a fading world. I wonder, reading it, if Green thought that world would linger on as long as it did, actually, because I suspect, and again, this comes back to differences between French and British decolonisation. I mean, I think it's fair to say that by the time Green wrote the novel, decolonisation of the British Empire was pretty much on its way. It had obviously already lost India, if that's quite the right word, and was proceeding to pretty carefully, not entirely successfully, decolonise. I don't think that's quite the same thing that the French experienced. Again, I think that that's implied in the book, implicit if not explicit. And there's a new master on the scene as well. And it's almost like an act of resistance by Green, or the person is Green there, of a world he's dissatisfied with, but perhaps he's always been dissatisfied with the world.
The idea that the death throes of the French colonial empire went kicking and screaming and biting and gouging in a way that the British sort of sighed and let go. As far as you could correct me on this, but I believe there was no colony that the British left tail between legs, having been defeated militarily by an insurgency, period. And that defines both the case in Indochina and in Algeria. Smaller colonies, I'm not so sure, in West Africa. But I think that is a great degree of the maybe the gulf between even Fowler, Green, lumping it together as all, oh, we're the old colonialists, uses that expression in the novel quite a bit to flatten the experience together. About the idea of detachment, so I watched the 2002 film version to get ready for this conversation, and I was struck by how Fowler and then Fuang at various moments look down from the balcony of his flat in a very Parisian-looking street in Saigon. And I'd just been at a special exhibit on the Impressionist Gustave Caillebotte, who did a lot of these paintings of people looking down from the brand new Haussmannified balconies down into the street, and the idea of this certain idea of detachment and proprietary gaze looking down at the street. And certainly I think that is, and go back to the tower, right, that sort of Fowler is up in the tower, up on the balcony, looking down at events below with a certain objectivity, a certain higher view. But of course, he's not uninvolved. He gives signals from the balcony that results in Pyle's death, signaling to the quasi-communist intriguers that he's made contact with. So it's the illusion of detachment, even though you are part of the street, you are part of this little world that I guess only lasts 20 or so more years after the events of the novel. 1955, it's published. Saigon falls, 75.
Yeah. It's testament to his craft that he's able to do that in the prose. And I'm thinking of that first time he's up in the tower, in the first point where Fowler's in the conflict. He's in a destroyed cathedral, and he's up in one of the belfries. And he's watching a French plane drop parachutists into a... trying to relieve an outpost somewhere. And he says it looks like a postcard of the Boer War. But he knows it's an illusion, because he says he knows the plane is circling and throwing out parachutists one by one. But he says, you know, each time you looked at it, it looks like a postcard. It looks like they're stuck in midair. So there's this incredibly powerful awareness of exactly that problem. I think that's why it's such a good novel, arguably a great novel, because Green really meets that charge head on of detachment. He's constantly worrying at that problem in a really stylish way. It's a very, you know, I think it's at the beginning of part two, that section. I think if people are going to read the novel, just read that bit and reflect on, like, that's very good writing. You know, it's very clever.
There's definitely some part of that question of detachment versus being engagé, as they say, that is heavily tinged with some good old-fashioned Orientalism about the idea that the West is active and striving and blustering in, and sort of the broadly conceived East is stoic and passive, and there's the gesture of the grieving mother covering her daughter's body with the hat as a kind of gesture of propriety and modesty, but ultimately kind of stoically accepting this fate. But I think you're right that it's a struggle. It's not just the idea that detachment or stoicism is the quote-unquote correct response to tragedy or to moral dilemmas.
I mean, it's one of many books, whether fact or fiction, that have been written on the Vietnam War, whether from the period in which France was dominant and then later, of course, the more famous and more written about episode when the United States was the principal agent. The first time I came across a book that wrote about that was Michael Hare's Dispatches. And then we had the surfeit of films that dealt with the Vietnam War during the 1970s, particularly The Deer Hunter and Apocalypse Now, which are so different from one another. But the one thing I suppose that we haven't got, that I'd love to have had, because this would have been towards the end of his life, is Green's thoughts 20 years on from writing The Quiet American. One wonders, I can't recall any interviews, they may well exist, with Green towards the end of his life about his experiences in Indochina, but what his view was as to what had happened in those last 20 years. And wouldn't it have been great had we had a follow-up to The Quiet American? But that's a bit too much to hope for.
It's funny you say a follow-up to it. I do sort of see The Quiet American as a successor to The End of the Affair as war novels, one with, you know, obviously not detachment, the whole idea that the narrator is in constant mortal danger. I'll admit I'll date myself here in the other sense by saying the first Vietnam book I read was Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, which is drawn from real life, but written quite a bit after the kind of in medias res stories that were written in the 60s and 70s.
The one thing I'd like just like to end on, Jonathan, since you are across the ponds, we want your view as an American, maybe, when you look at the amount of interest there now is in the US in the Vietnam War, the Lynn Novick, Ken Burns documentary, but there's plenty more out there, revisionist histories, more of a debate over what was seen, I think, as something that, I don't know whether this is a myth or not, really, about how America viewed the war, but as a war that was kind of a dirty secret in a way. Wasn't publicly discussed and kind of went into the undergrowth of the American mind. How do you see books like The Quiet American in context with, you know, there is enormous recent interest in Vietnam. There are probably more accessible than ever accounts from the Vietnamese side as well. I think with the French involvement, I'm unaware really of how the debate has gone there, because I think it is rather overshadowed by Algeria, which kind of stands for, as you very insightfully observed, it kind of stands for a lot of the other conflicts the French are involved with. But yeah, how does it feel as an American coming to a novel like this?
Well, other than the kind of very low-hanging fruit jibes about, you know, cellophane and deodorant and, you know, good air conditioning, which, by the way, I'll stand by that. You know, Green is wrong to critique air conditioning. Air conditioning is the best invention ever. But on a serious note, I think that Vietnam, as this touchstone, as this stand-in for American intervention overseas, American neo-imperialism overseas, is now overlaid with what you might call Vietnam II, that is, Iraq. And these conflicts kind of fuse into a single story of American aggression and blundering and overconfident belief in the ability to reshape societies, where Vietnam and kind of the Vietnam syndrome reemerging with Iraq syndrome becomes a stand-in for sort of everything America has done. Or if you're going to be a little bit kind of complexified a little bit, you'd say there's the good war, World War II, and then a bunch of bungling disasters that leave a bloody trail behind them. So I think we see that now with the first crop of kind of global war on terror movies. We have this film Warfare, we have the Hurt Locker about bomb defusing, but really they are in the Vietnam War movie tradition in terms of viewing the overall conflict as a misguided boondoggle. So I would say there's still a very hardcore of people like Mark Moyer, whose book Triumph Forsaken was basically saying the Vietnam War was won militarily and was lost by maybe not a stab in the back legend, but lost due to political vacillation and to cultural backlash from anti-war activists and hippies and a sort of disloyal left. So I think that's still very much a minority view. I think virtually there's a consensus that the Vietnam War was a disaster, and is almost in your consensus now on Iraq. So I think the attention is appropriate for the scale of the conflict, but I think it can, in some cases, obscure more than it illuminates if it becomes the one master key to understanding American power in the world. The only key.
Yeah, of course, history is a bit more complex than that. Well, thank you, Jonathan. That was fascinating. Thanks for coming on, and thanks for calling in from Washington.